Classic City Vibes Podcast, conversations with musicians, artists, creatives, and others who make Athens, Georgia, and the community surrounding Athens an amazing place to live. Learn what is going on in one of the nation's most famous scenes, meet the new generation of people keeping the tradition strong, and hear how the arts are helping build our communities. This podcast is put out by the Athens Regional Library System, where we are committed to helping build strong communities and celebrating our diversity, engaging communities, exceeding expectations. If you enjoy the podcast, please make sure to give us a rating or review on iTunes.
All right, today we have Jake Shane Lee in with us today. He's a composer, teacher, and percussionist. Thanks for coming in today, Shane. Jake.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Call you Shane.
Not all good. All good. My dad's nickname was Shane for years, and I go,
oh, really?
A lot of my friends call me Shane Lee, so totally fine.
Well, start. So you're a percussionist. As a percussionist, do you feel like that's a strength in your compositional works that you do? Is it something, does that give you like an insight to rhythm that someone maybe who plays violin is more melody oriented, or does that play into how you, yourself as a composer?
I would say absolutely, yeah. I a lot of times think about, you know, the way I compose is I take small little ideas, motifs, things like that, and then layer them together and put them into like, you know, kind of a mosaic. And a lot of times those will be rhythmically driven. And I think, one of my teachers told me it's rhythm can be almost more important than melody sometimes. If you play, for example, random notes, but with the correct rhythm, you can maybe recognize it more often than if you play the wrong notes but the right rhythm. Other way around. If you play the right notes but the wrong rhythm, it's harder to recognize. So yes, I would say that rhythm is a incredibly important part of my music, and I think about rhythm in ways that kind of permutate over time in the way percussion rudiments might and the way they kind of interact with each other. So taking something that maybe is one measure long and, you know, seven notes or something like that, and then shifting it slightly so then it's off by a note, or layering that so then two people are kind of doing things that are just off from each other, like an echo. And that is something that I've encountered less in composers' music who focus on the kind of like melodic thing. So as a percussionist, I would say that I generally tend towards that kind of approach.
And have you always composed that way?
Not always, I don't think. I began composing when I was late in high school, composing for like classical music. I played in bands and wrote songs and stuff for years, but composing from a academic standpoint, I didn't start doing that until I was in high school.
And did you see it as academic at that time, or did you see it already as kind of like a creative outlet?
It was absolutely a creative thing. I always talk about the reason that I kind of started writing music at all, because I've basically written things since I first started playing when I was like seven.
And you started playing drums?
I started playing guitar when I was seven.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I played guitar first. I picked up drums when I was, I think, 9 or 10. And that was because of this constantly on tables and my parents getting very angry. So they were just like, we'll get you drums. Just get it out. But luckily, my parents were really supportive of that. So I appreciate that very much. But anyways, I would say I started composing, you know, when I was really young, kind of because I couldn't play things that I liked. I couldn't play music that I heard, songs that I was listening to, because they were too difficult. So I'd write things that were within my capabilities. So, you know, simple guitar riffs and things like that, drum beats that were like within my skill level. Right. And then that slowly branched out, and, you know, my music would, as my skills increased, then my music would get more complicated. And then it kind of got to this turning point in high school where I decided to take a music theory class, and I was somewhat familiar. I had taken, private lessons this whole time, and one of my teachers was very into music theory and was constantly talking about that, but my high school offered a class that I had never taken, and it was music theory. And so I decided to take it as an elective, having not been in band or orchestra or chorus or anything. And that kind of was the impetus of me getting into like classical music and starting to compose from that that perspective. Writing orchestra music was the first kind of thing that I was really passionate about. I really don't think I'd be where I am without lots of film music, and, you know, being that that's pretty orchestra dominant.
Is that where you first kind of got interested, is film music?
Yeah. Listening to, growing up with Star Wars and Indiana Jones, any of John Williams' scores are just incredible. And that is basically what really got me into it. And then seeing where he and other of his contemporaries got their influences from, looking back to then like Gustav Holst or Mahler or Wagner. Yeah. And then that kind of got me into like the true classical music. And that was a slippery slope. I just took the plunge right away. And then, you know, by my first semester of undergrad, I was going to go for music recording, production, engineering, things like that. And ended up deciding one day that I'm just going to go to the composition department and talk to the chair. And he was like, "Yeah, let's do this." And I declared my major as composition instead. So it's funny how things work out.
Well, it sounds like that you almost started composing. Like you said, like that's not, you know, a lot of people who are into music don't, you know, "I can't play but three chords, I'm going to write my own songs." Sure. That's not necessarily the first thing people go to. So it sounds like it's almost natural for you to want to create your own music.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember having a conversation with a student in high school once I was kind of in band in that world toward, like, you know, my last couple of years. And I remember talking to her and saying, "Hey, you should try to like write something. It's fun." And she just was like, "No, I don't understand why." And so it's like, it was so foreign to me because that's something that's just so kind of innate in my musical blood, I guess. And then going to college for it and meeting so many people where it's like, it's the same idea. Like they can't imagine themselves not writing things. And, you know, even I've considered, like I was saying, I consider recording music for a living and things like that. And I still do that, you know, on the side, but every time I consider those possibilities, something happens and I'm like, "No, I can't envision myself writing, they're not writing music."
Yeah. Composing is your main love.
Yes.
Yeah. So I've always wondered if when you're composing something for, you know, a quartet or orchestra or whatever, and you don't play the instruments, how difficult is it to kind of make sure you're in the range of what's reasonable to play, what's the upper limit of a normal player's capabilities, that kind of thing. How does that work in terms of as a composer? I've always been interested in that.
Yeah, it takes time. It takes a lot of time and study and talking to players. I've been lucky to basically, since growing up, everyone I've been surrounded with, whether it's, you know, friends, my dad played guitar, like everyone around me has played music in some capacity. Lots of different instruments too. You know, my dad played guitar. I had friends play trumpet and flute and clarinet, and I was a percussionist. So just knowing all different players, and then continuing to college where you have an entire orchestra at your disposal. You might have to go out and find them, but they're there somewhere. But it takes time and just practice and listening. And I think listening is something that I even think I struggle with sometimes, like just listening to new music and different things that I haven't heard before and kind of dissecting that and seeing what happens in parts for different instruments and thinking about. I think for me, it's gotten to the point where the colors that I'm looking for in the piece, whether that's, you know, instrumentation or the way the instruments are playing, kind of, it's tough to describe. It's gotten to a point where that almost is just natural, and it just is kind of, "Oh yeah, I wouldn't do this in the brass because the way brass works, it's complicated." But it's not, you're not going to put some crazy fast thing in the brass like you would maybe in a woodwind instrument. And so then I just, when I'm composing, I'm hearing things that are just natural for those instruments. Just from listening and hearing things. And then when you kind of experiment with things that might not be more traditional, then you have to kind of talk to players who do know what's going on and say, "Hey, what's this like?" And that's, again, the fact that I had so many different musicians of different instruments and different backgrounds surrounding me growing up, and to this day, it's really a blessing to have that at my disposal. So yeah, talking to people, listening to music.
So does that happen automatically now, or do you sometimes hear something like, in a brass, just as an example, like, "Oh, that actually won't work in brass," but you hear it in your head. and you're like, oh, this will have to come to the woodwinds. Yeah. Or are you kind of trained now, or you already hear kind of what the where the limits are?
I think generally I'll hear an idea, and if it is kind of maybe out of that range, or I think generally the way I compose is not necessarily instrument dependent to begin with. My music is very harmonically, like chords and melody driven. And so my first thought is, what do I want the chords to be doing here? And what do I want the melody to be doing here? And maybe how exactly are they presented? Is the chord just like a long chord? Is it like, bup, 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 bup? Or is it like moving lines, like this really beautiful, lush thing? Or is it like a choir where it's just big, da, da, long chords? And then that is what I'm kind of hearing. Not necessarily, oh, I'm hearing this in the trumpets. I'm hearing this specific texture. How can I split it up in a way that fits those instruments, if that makes sense? So rather than saying, I want to write this thing in the trumpet that doesn't quite work, I want to write this thing, where will it work?
Work at. Yeah. And it's since you are so rhythmically minded, is that an area where maybe a player might find some of your work more difficult to play? Are your rhythms complex?
And sometimes, yes. Yeah. It's interesting. I have found, especially because a lot of with composing, there's going to be sight reading sessions where just the ensemble gets it, they just read it down, and that's it. They don't get to rehearse it much. And so I've slowly been, and it's still a work in progress, but getting my music to the point where even when it is more rhythmically complicated or melodically, you know, rangy or things like that, it's still readable. Like where readable as in on a first or second pass. I'm actually, there's a piece that I just finished about a month ago or so that's getting read 2 weeks. And so that piece is pretty rhythmically complex. And so far, the players haven't said anything. They said they're looking over it, and they haven't complained yet. But yeah, I would say that there are times where I've written things. I wrote a duet for flute and guitar, which is an interesting combination. Yeah. A lot of people are familiar, and that's going to be played next month in November. And that piece,
where is it going to be played at?
University of Georgia the Hodgson Hall. I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, so that piece, it's in a weird time signature, lots of more beats than you would expect in a measure. And the way the flute interacts with the guitar, the guitar suggests a really clear grouping of notes. The flute is just kind of like over top of that. And the flutist who is playing it hasn't said anything, but I've had flutists in the past say, what am I supposed to do here? Because once you hear it, a lot of times that's the other thing is... sometimes my music, what is written on the page looks a lot nastier than it is.
Yes, yeah.
So the way this is, you know, grouped and written on the page can look, oh, that's really weird and not, you know, readable. But then when you hear it, it's like, oh, it interacts and interlocks with the guitar, you know, immediately. So yes, that has happened many times.
How different is it when you write a large piece? Because obviously you can't, it's, you know, if I'm a singer-songwriter, I play the song. I hear it while I'm writing the song. How different is it for writing for a large piece when you actually hear it from what you had in mind, what you saw on the page? And is there like a revision process with that?
Sometimes. Yeah. A lot of times you don't get that opportunity.
But you wish you could.
Yes. And the more opportunities that you have to write for a large ensemble, the better it will be, the more you'll get used to it. And that goes back to writing things that are idiomatic for instruments, things that fit within those instruments' ranges or things like that. Sometimes you don't really know until it gets to that point. For example, like the clarinet has a break, like your vocal break when you kind of crack into like falsetto. It happens the same way in clarinet, and if you try to write things that kind of hang out in that area, it's really difficult. And so that's something that you might not know, thinking, oh, just it's this range, you know, the clarinet can go down from here up to here. You might not realize that there's an issue in the middle. And so things like that you might not notice until you hear it. Regarding, you know, large ensemble things in general, though, we are lucky today to have you know, MIDI and things like that, where we can play it back. Obviously, it's not super accurate, but you can get a sense.
But you already have an idea what it's going to sound like.
Yeah, you can get a sense for pacing and stuff. I generally don't use that as a guideline because it's very one. It's robotic. It's not. It's gotten really good, but it's still not super accurate, and it's never going to. The blending is going to be way different. That's the biggest thing with large ensemble is in MIDI. The woodwinds are going to be super clear and crisp. The strings are going to be so loud and powerful, and the brass will blend in nicely. If you write a piece, it's going to be, if everyone's playing, you know, forte, fortissimo, the brass is going to be screaming, and then everyone else, you might not even hear the winds. And I wrote a piece for the Carnegie Mellon Orchestra, who was my graduate capstone piece there. And that piece, the orchestration, I'm really happy with. I'm happy with how it came out. But the way the dynamics were written, I had at the very end of the piece, it just gets super loud and aggressive, and everyone was marked, you know, forte, 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 like three Fs, and the brass just went off, and I had the tuba player came up to me after, and he was like, "I've never been allowed to play that loud before." But that's not what I wanted. I wanted everyone to be, you know, loud and balanced, but that's something that you don't really know until the day of.
Yeah.
And luckily, because we have conductors, the conductor can guide them and say, hey, it is marked this way, but we still need to play, you know, together. And that's one of the biggest things is the way things blend.
Yeah, explain a little bit about the role of a conductor versus the composer. Sure. And the relationship as a composer with a conductor.
Yeah.
See, maybe there might be some differences of opinion and things of that nature.
There definitely can be. Yeah. I have been fortunate to work with a lot of different conductors, including myself as a conductor. So it really depends on the conductor, what the interaction is like, what the atmosphere is like. A good conductor will make the piece into what the composer is looking for to the best of their ability, while at the same time taking it places that maybe even the composer wouldn't have expected. I've definitely had conductors suggest things that I just never thought of. And I was like, that is so much better than what I was thinking. And in particular, the conductor who conducted my graduate capstone piece, Daniel Curtis, is an amazing conductor, incredible musician, and just so down to earth and just willing to like listen, but also take the piece somewhere where make it his own, but make it a unique performance where he's adding something to it.
His knowledge.
Yes.
And
yeah. And I've also had conductors, especially there are big differences between the traditions in Europe versus America. And one of my pieces that was premiered in Europe was conducted by an American conductor, but in the context under she was kind of working under a European conductor, and he was very much a stickler about certain things.
Yeah.
And the conductor herself was like, hey, this is, you know, an American piece. We're going to kind of approach it like this. And he was like, no. And it was, you know, so that can happen sometimes. He's still great.
He's entrenched kind of in a certain way of you do things certain way.
Right.
So the music, when a conductor pretty much goes by that, it's not like in theater, you know, they go by the script per se. In films, they do whatever they want. They may not need to look anything like the script. So is composing more similar to theater in the sense that it's pretty much going to be played how you write it?
It will essentially have to be.
Yeah.
From a conductor's perspective especially, there are techniques, compositional techniques and things like that, where they do involve what's called aleatory. I don't know if you're familiar. Like, it's chance music.
Terry Riley and the Sea.
Yeah, absolutely. So with Terry Riley, that piece in particular, he kind of gave. he kind of gave like little fragments, and then you kind of continue those for a while, and there's a new fragment that you'll take, and they all kind of do that and slowly changes keys and things like that.
Yeah.
That's one way of doing it.
Do you like that style?
I it depends on the piece. It really does. I like certain pieces, and it's the case with any style, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Because I can't say I like all romantic music or classical music either.
Do you use chants in your music?
Sometimes. Yeah. Usually as an effect. A lot of composers, not all composers, but there are many composers who use that as like the basis of their music, where the piece will be a little box on the staff with some notes and then an arrow that just says kind of do this for a while. I'll do that maybe with one player. Like there was a piece that I wrote. It was my capstone project for my undergraduate degree that had everyone was supposed to, the woodwinds were supposed to kind of click their keys without actually blowing in. So you just get this kind of clicky-clacky sound under what else is happening. And that kind of thing, they can do what they want. I just want them to, you know, do this. So I would just write, you know, key clicks random and then an arrow. But I usually don't leave the whole ensemble to do that.
Yeah.
Other than that kind of thing, generally, yes, they're going to stick to exactly what's written. And even in that case, they're still doing what's written. What's written is just basically it says improvise, you know?
Right, sure.
So,
yeah. So with classical music, concert music, or whatever terminology you want to use for, I know classical is not the actual term, but it's hard to say what term to use that people actually know, kind of thing. But Baroque, classical, new music, all that put together. So there's such a like commitment to the repertoire, you know. How does that affect a young composer actually be able to get your music played?
It is tough sometimes. Yeah. Luckily, there are a lot of new music ensembles these days. There are a lot of orchestras who are into that kind of thing. The big orchestras, though, I'm thinking, you know, the big four, like Chicago, Boston, New York, things like that.
Yeah.
They generally stick to like one or two living composers, and that's about it. There is,
and by living, they're probably at the end of their career.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I can think of maybe like Jennifer Higdon is not,
right.
You know, she's still in her prime and, you know, going strong, and she gets played regularly, but. Thinking of like other composers that
almost never.
It's rare. Yeah. Maybe more smaller regional orchestras, but yeah. So it is difficult. But again, in the compositional world, there are a lot of luckily players and ensembles who are really into that and playing new things, and getting this music out there. Because at least in, you know, musical academia, there is a kind of push to. Not get rid of the repertoire, the canon, but expand it and add new things to it. And it seems like generally we're at least 50 years behind on that. So, you know, the things that major orchestras will play regularly, probably nothing in the past, you know, 50 years, probably more at this point, going back to like the 1950s maybe.
That's crazy.
Yeah. They'll maybe do a one-off concert.
Sure,
but they're not going to play... you know, regular pieces from living composers. And unfortunately it's a money thing. It's what, you know, concert goers want to see. What the demographic of concert goers, they're gonna want to see, hey, I wanna go see
everyone's heard of Mahler.
You know, I wanna go to see Mahler's Fifth Symphony. I wanna go see Beethoven's Ninth, you know. And I don't at all have a problem with that. I love all of that music, and I also want to hear that and go see it.
It's finding a balance.
Yes, yeah, it's finding a balance. Yeah. And that, unfortunately, we still haven't gotten to that point yet. But again, luckily, there is a growing number of new music ensembles, especially chamber works.
Yeah.
A lot of chamber ensembles are dedicated to new music. I had a piece premiered by the Mivos Quartet. I don't know if you're familiar. They're a string quartet who is basically on the forefront of American new music for that instrumentation. And they're all about it. Yeah. I don't think they really play, you know, canon repertoire at all.
There's enough people already do that.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And they've made themselves known for not doing that.
Right.
And so they find that kind of that balance. It would also be cool to have ensembles that do both, you know, that just treat music as music. The thing is I think it also is a programming thing. You know, if you have a concert and you have, I don't know, one of Bach's Brandenburg concertos, and then you have a Schoenberg serialist, really atonal dissonant piece, it'd be pretty weird. The instrumentation
would
also
be
I would down. Too. I would too. But the instrumentation would also be different, and that has to do with, you know, players and paying them. Would you pay them for the whole concert, even though they're only playing for part of it?
Yeah.
You know?
Right, yeah.
Right, because, like, Bach is not going to have all this auxiliary percussion or anything. but Schoenberg might. And so the people that want to go to different concerts just have a different interest. And so because of that, it's tough to find that mix where we can do both. And so generally it is kind of split between, okay, here's a night of new music, and then here's, you know, everything else.
Yeah. So really you'd just be nice to have maybe a few more nights of new music instead of just a night of new music.
And the other thing is playing new pieces more than once. Yeah. That's real, real tough. I'm lucky to have had a few pieces performed, you know, numerous occasions and still, you know, getting played. A lot of people, you know, don't get that opportunity.
So what's that process like? You write a piece. How do you actually get it out there into the world?
It depends. It depends on the piece. A lot of times, pieces that I've had performed were commissions or written for a particular ensemble. I'm thinking that Mivos Quartet piece. That wasn't like, I wrote this string quartet and I'm going to talk to Mivos. It was like, hey, Mivos is coming.
Can you
write a piece for us?
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay. And then they were like, yeah, they picked it and they're like, let's play this and we'll premiere for you.
That was pretty exciting for you.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. That was actually my first official premiere, other than just me and my friends. That was my...
What a great way to start.
It was crazy. And they had no idea until after, because I just forgot to tell them, I guess. And I sent them a thank you note and they were like, wow, we had no idea that was your first, you know, ever premiere. But yeah, usually it's writing for something, you know, thinking... I wrote a piece for the Sofia Philharmonic, which is in Sofia, Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. That was written specifically for that orchestra. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't write a piece and then say, hey, you know, in Bulgaria, you want to play this.
Right.
It's for them. So generally, that's how that kind of thing happens. It's not always. I did, actually, my repeat pieces were generally written for a purpose. And then another ensemble found them and said, hey, we like this. We'll play it. I'm thinking of one of my pieces called In Synergy. It's kind of has to do with this combination of themes that kind of doesn't work at first. Yeah. And they're all really disparate. And then at the end, they kind of combine together, but in a way that you don't quite expect. And that piece was written for, actually, it was written for the ensemble Face, who's a Viennese ensemble. Chamber music, so it's like six players. It was written for them. The premiere was canceled because of COVID. And then the ensemble Tempo, who is part of California State, Northridge, they picked it up and they're like, hey, we'll premiere this, you know, a few months later. And I was like, okay, great. And then I recorded that piece as well. So that was actually an instance where I was like, I want to have a good studio quality recording of this piece. I'm just going to hire six people to play for a couple hours. It's a lot of money, but it's, you know, it's worth it.
Yeah.
And then I have like a quality recording. Cause that's the other thing with live performances. Sometimes it's not as good as you'd expect. If there's a mistake, what are you going to do? And I've actually had multiple pieces where the rehearsal was better, which is really unfortunate.
That's gotta be really frustrating as a composer, right?
Right. But it
you understand as a performer as well.
But yeah, I do. Yeah, there was one of my orchestra pieces. It was my capstone orchestra piece for my master's, had this really high trumpet part where it was in the range perfectly fine. But it was high. And, during the rehearsal, to save their chops, because brass musicians, they're buzzing their lips and that can get tiring fast. They played it down the octave. And we did record the dress rehearsal, so we had it, but that part was different, so I couldn't really use that. And at the concert, he missed the note multiple times.
Oh, yeah. No.
He got it once,
and
I was able to splice it, so it worked.
Modern technology, thank goodness.
I don't know what I would do. If I was using tape, I would... Not have a career without tape.
A different world.
Yeah.
Well, kind of like earlier you said, like, you can hear things on MIDI, but that wasn't the case before. So before, when composers were writing, I guess they really, really didn't hear it until it was in practice, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so in those instances, you'd really have to, you'd have to take as many opportunities to hear your music as possible, even if it's just a 5-minute reading session of just a tiny piece. Or even just like a bunch of ideas that you have that you won't even make into a piece. For example, if you had like 30 seconds of music that wasn't really going anywhere, but it was just different textures that you're exploring, that's what you would have to do. and say, okay, I know that this is going to work now. I can do these alterations to it and it should still work. And then find out the night of the concert. And so the people that gelled with right away, you know, the great composers of history, you know, they had a gift.
Yeah.
They really did. And I try to not rely on that. So I can use it for kind of pacing because I'm not a great pianist. And a lot of composers are pianists. I can play piano. But, you know, I'm thinking of, I had one composition teacher who could take a full orchestra score with, you know, 30 parts and play it on piano all at once, sight reading. And I cannot do that.
Wow.
She has a major advantage because then if she's writing, she can say, okay, for like pacing purposes, you know, how fast things are happening, I can just play through. I can't do that. Yeah. So I try my best. And sometimes I'll record things like with just piano and then play it back and then see how that sounds and then maybe splice something new in that I do and then actually notate it. I'm thinking of, again, my graduate capstone piece. I composed that entirely at the piano, and actually some of it I composed without piano, just kind of thinking about what I already had and then making adjustments in my head. But yeah, it's tough without hearing it. It's something that it takes years and years to be able to do.
Is there a certain format that you prefer? Not format, but it's like duets, quartets, chamber, orchestra, that you prefer to write?
Orchestra,
that's the one, yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not something that necessarily is something you can do every day. I like large ensemble in general, so I also enjoy, you know, like wind ensemble, band music, things like that, which I'm currently working on a piece for band. But yeah, I would definitely say orchestra, just the variety of colors that you can get with that and as compared to something like, I also like chamber music. I like the string quartet a lot. I've written two full, you know, multi-movement string quartets at this point. But I generally like things with lots of mixed colors. Mm. So something like string quartet, strings, even though there's, you know, four different instruments and four different players, three different instruments because you have two violins, viola, cello, they're all pretty homogeneous sound-wise. They all have a very similar blending tone. With something like Puro ensemble, which is flute, clarinet, violin, cello, piano, sometimes percussion, sometimes bass, but usually not. That's got a lot of different sounds. We have piano, which has like really sharp attack. You have clarinet, which can have pretty soft attack. You have flute, which is just vastly different from both of those. And then you have the two strings that can blend nicely. You have so many different colors there. And adding percussion, you have even more. And so it's kind of like a mini orchestra. So I also like that. But generally I like orchestra because it just, you can do anything with it.
But is that also the hardest to get performed?
Yes.
Because there's,
yes.
You know, it's obviously going to be less orchestras than quartets,
right?
Just by how difficult and expensive it is to put that on.
So. Right. And you can't just, with a quartet, I could find four people and say, hey, play this. With that, I can't.
Yeah.
So I have considered doing a multi-track orchestra recording where I find one of each player, have them record separately and put it all together. I still haven't.
That's still a lot.
It still would be, yeah, it'd be a lot.
Yeah.
And if I was paying any of them, it would add up quickly. So
maybe later when you have a little
maybe,
more money.
Yeah, or maybe at a point where just I know enough people that are like, yeah, I'll just do it for free.
Yeah. So you're also in a band.
Yes.
Well, what kind of music are you playing in your band?
So I'm in kind of three different groups,
okay.
One active band, one band who is kind of on hiatus for a few reasons, and I'll get into that, and one band which is just kind of a songwriting duo, and we record things as a band would, but like multi-track with just the two of us.
Oh, nice.
So my primary active band is called Snowchild, two words. Not one, there is a band with one word. But we're kind of like...
They suck, you're good, right?
we're like very different genre.
Right, okay.
It's really eclectic music, and it's always tough to describe. The best way I can think of it is like progressive alternative rock. We grew up all... The bassist and I went to Berkeley for undergrad together. That's how we met. The pianist it's a piano-driven band rather than guitar. There is guitar. But the pianist and singer, he and I grew up together in Buffalo. and the guitarist was the pianist's friend who I didn't meet until later, but they grew up together. So kind of he was the mutual friend.
Oh, nice.
And so the bassist and I grew up listening to Rush, things like that. Yes, progressive rock.
Very orchestrated
yes,
music.
Yes, absolutely. He was a huge King Crimson fan. I am as well, but probably he was like really into that. But things like that. The guitarist is from a metal background, so he listened to like metalcore and post-hardcore and things like that. And he's actually in a, I guess they're like new metalcore. They're kind of like new metal, but way heavier with like screaming vocals. And he's the screamer, so it's cool. And then he just sits and plays like little quiet riffs on his guitar. And then we have the piano, which is kind of the main driven instrument. He has just this eclectic taste. Grew up listening to the progressive rock like me and the bassist, and but also listening to metal and listening to classical music like me, jazz. I think his favorite pianist of all time is Chick Corea. And so the synthesis of all of that, it is really out there. And so the pianist, like I said, sings. The bassist sings backing vocals, crazy high range, does all the, like Geddy Lee harmonies in the background. And then I sometimes sing, but I play drums, so playing and singing is a little bit tricky, especially when I'm playing such intricate music, because it's like almost jazz metal at times, where the drums are, heavy, hard-hitting drums, and then we have jazz piano chords and things like that happening, and then like shoegaze guitar things with lots of reverb and delay, and then just this like crushing bass sound. So it's an interesting combination. With
sounds great.
Yeah.
So how's the songwriting go? Because as a composer, you're completely in charge, and as a band, it's a little more complicated, right?
I take a back seat usually.
Yeah.
Is
that on purpose?
Yeah. It's kind of. It's a combination. So the project started. The pianist and I have been making music for years together. He's a few years older than me, and I think when I was like 11 or 12, we met. We took lessons at the same music store, and he was insane, Debussy Prelude sweeping piano chops. I was like, dude, we got to do something with this. I was playing Rush songs, and he was like, let's combine that. And it didn't work for years. We were like, how do we make this like gel? And we went through a few singers, not figuring out what to do, but he always had songs. He was always writing songs. At first they started as these really like epic, long, compositions, really through composed. There wasn't like, a chorus where everybody could sing along and things like that. And just really intricate parts and dense harmonies. And he would sing, but he was never confident in his vocals because he was never trained. And then as the years went by, we slowly kind of settled on this formula where he will bring a pretty good skeleton of a song. So he'll have the chords, but maybe not the way the chords are played. So he'll just know that, okay, these four beats are going to be this chord, but I don't know what I'm going to do or what anyone else is going to do. He'll have a rough idea of the melody, and then that's about it for these sections. Then I come in and I work more as, rather than a composer, more of a producer. And so I think about what kind of groove can we apply to this? It would be the same concept as if you had a singer-songwriter just strumming guitar chords and maybe not knowing just yet what's going to happen with that drum-wise and bass and things like that. And so I come in and say, okay, what kind of layers can we add here? I write a lot of the guitar parts, actually. And then the guitarist comes in and puts his own touch on that. So then we make, demos with the two of us using the beauty of technology.
Yeah.
And so the two of us demo out what he has. I put my layers into it and crazy rhythms and things like that. You'll probably hear more of that crazy stuff rhythmically that you were talking about before in that music than my classical music, actually. Because I can get away with it when I'm the one playing it.
You know your limitations.
Right.
You know what you can do. Yeah.
Right. Whereas I've given rhythms like that to classical musicians, and they do it, but right. They're not happy about it.
They don't like you anymore.
No. So that's basically how the process
works. So is that what you like about it, is that you get to like really play with rhythms that you can't in your classical art?
Kind of, yeah. And especially because the other guys are also super into it.
All right.
And
they're not mad at you.
No.
Like, yeah.
No, and the vocabulary of that music is very different. And thinking about composition is a lot of it, more than you might think, is the same. And the way things are developed and the way ideas, you know, happen over time.
Theory's theory, right?
Yeah. But there is a difference. And the way rhythms, you can get away with doing things a certain way there. Stylistically, that's just fits into the kind of paradigm of that type of music, because we generally fit into that kind of post-hardcore kind of area that might be a little bit weird in classical music. And I've also just kind of developed two simultaneous vocabularies just separate of each other. My, you know, chordal vocabulary is different in my classical music than Jared's is in Snowchild. And because of that, you can, again, get away with different things. You can do different things and approach things differently from that perspective. So that's why I can kind of do the rhythmic thing there.
So what's that like live for you?
It's interesting. Yeah. We haven't played a whole ton live yet.
Yeah. Because they're complicated like that, it would be hard to pull off.
Yeah. We've done it, and it works really well. There's a few reasons for why we haven't, you know, officially, let's say, we're just going to do a tour now.
Yeah.
One of them is the bassist. I said we met at Berkeley. He's from Virginia. So the pianist and guitarist are from Buffalo, as am I, and I'm here. And so we're all over the place. So it's tough to, like, the recording of that record, we kind of came together, did some rehearsals, and then just, like, recorded it, like, separately. So we only played those songs. Actually, some of them we never heard live in one room ever until they were recorded. So that was an interesting thing to figure out. So the one is the distance. Two, yeah, the logistics are pretty crazy. There's with just four of us, there's lots of layering to do or that are on the studio recording that we – it's tough to replicate live, you know.
You need more people.
Right. Yeah. Three of us singing harmonies, you know, like Beatles style. It's tough when we're not playing Beatles songs, you know. We're playing, and I'm going like this and trying to keep my head steady so I can sing.
Right.
And there's, like, keyboard layers that sometimes the bassist will do. With the guitar, there's so many different crazy effects and stuff. So sometimes we'll use some, like, sequencing things where we can, if we run him through the computer, the guitar, then we can program some things to put crazy effects on, and then he just has to worry about playing. And so that's one way we've kind of worked it out. We've gotten to a pretty good spot where we can replicate the whole record live.
So maybe in Athens one day we'll get to see.
We're really, really pushing for it.
That'd be cool.
Because there's just such a vibrant music scene there, and like... in Buffalo, where we played a show in Buffalo, actually, shortly before I drove down here for the semester. And the music scene there is very cover-based. It's all cover music all the time. That's basically, if you can play in an original band, it's really
it's
difficult.
Hard. Yeah.
Not saying that it's easy anywhere else, like here, but it seems like it's much more, like, encouraged, and, like, people go out to see original music, whereas in Buffalo, people don't go to see local shows, you know. They go to the bar, and there happens to be a cover band there. And you can make good money doing that, but you can't really play original music, which is unfortunate. So we're really hoping that the guys will get down here and get to it.
Yeah, so let's talk about a little bit about what's been your opinion of your experience of the Athens music scene since you've been here.
It's really vibrant,
amazing.
As I said. Yeah. I've lived in, you know, a few different cities, bigger cities, smaller cities. I grew up in a tiny rural town with I was one of three musicians, besides maybe the banjo playing guy down the street. No, I'm kidding. But
he might make it to one of your songs.
He might. But it's cool because it's so close knit. And for example, the bassist of Snowchild has another band, and they're on tour right now, and he was. You know, they ran into some issues and unfortunately could not make it to Athens. But they were supposed to, and the band that they're playing with is all people that I know. And I had no idea. But, like, the way these local shows work out, it's cool that people know each other and, like, go out to, you know, shows like that. And in addition with, you know, UGA, there's so many young people that want to go out and see music work. And in like Buffalo, it's all older people who just want to hear hit songs.
Songs, that's it.
So I really appreciate that there's like this push for creativity and like originality that I haven't seen a lot elsewhere.
Yeah. What about classical music?
That I'm still kind of exploring. Yeah. So that we have some great ensembles as part of University of Georgia, but outside of that, there's not. I can't think of any. There a lot of the ensembles are Atlanta based, which isn't again not, it's not too far. So those sure. They'll come here a lot, but a lot of it is through the university. They bring guest artists. Hillary Hahn was just here.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Crazy violinist. People like that. But so yeah, a lot of it's centered through the university. But there are lots of great musicians that are super into that. And, a lot of people and the local, popular music scene, I guess, if you want to, non-classical,
yeah.
I kind of bridge that. And they also play, classical music. I know a few people in the composition studio at UGA who just have a band and they play. But they also write music like I do. So yeah. It's not too separate, actually. There's quite a bit of overlap.
Which is good. That's a great thing.
There is.
What about your other two bands?
Okay, so band number two is Dream Spectrum. We were we're currently kind of on hiatus, I suppose. It was never like said that we're doing that, but for a few reasons. I've been away at school for years now. And, every time I come home, we usually get together and do some stuff. But the bassist recently moved with his wife to Nashville. And now he's doing the playing the circuit there, probably 13 gigs a week, something like that, which means two a day most days at least. So, he gets back to Buffalo when he can. The guitarist, we have two guitarists. And actually, I should clarify, it's an instrumental band. So we're like the people generally compare us to is like Joe Satriani, Eric Johnson kind of things. But treating it less as like a solo guitar thing and more as like a band that has guitar as like the lead singer, more like that. So the two guitarists, they're working and stuff. I'm still in school. So that's currently kind of on a haze. But that was my first band that we ever had. That was long before Snowchild, back when I was, like 12. And jamming in my basement playing like covers of, classic rock, shred songs, Van Halen, things like that, and with no singer though. So we kind of got known in the area for being that band that like would do instrumental versions of
you could shred a song. Yeah.
So like we played all over the place, tons of shows, cover shows, and but we'd be able to throw in original music because we were instrumental and we could kind of make it all just fit. So it wouldn't be like, we're playing all these hits and then we play this like weird indie song or something like that would be Snowchild. It would be odd.
Right.
Whereas with us, we could get away with, and people loved like the shred guitar theatrics and we're playing again music that reminds people of like hit songs. So
sure.
Yeah, that was cool. And we got to play some crazy stuff. We got to play Music Fest in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is like, I think that year, who Kesha headlined, I think. Oh, and so, yeah, we played with Kesha, of all people. Back in Buffalo, the Goo Goo Dolls are like the big thing there. And so we opened for them.
Are they from there?
Yeah, they're from Buffalo, okay. Yeah. So
is that the biggest band from Buffalo?
Yeah, I would say. Yeah, I would say so. I'm trying to think who else. Who else might be from Buffalo?
I think Athens has Buffalo beat in terms of music.
I would agree. I think the drummer for Weezer is from Buffalo.
Okay. Yeah.
Who else? The Billy Sheehan, the bassist, he played for
Mr. Big.
He's from Buffalo. Who else? Yeah. So the Goo Goo Dolls are like as a band.
The ones who made it the biggest.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That's cool
that you still play with this first band.
Yeah,
it's pretty rare.
Yeah, because I don't know, we were at one point we were like insane. We were rehearsing so much and just playing constantly live as a band and really just refining everything and playing gigs.
You were drums in that one too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. I with that one, I didn't do a lot of the writing. We would fit songs together. And I there was, I think, one or two songs that I brought to them. It's like, hey, this is my song. The drummer wrote the song. But for the most part, I'd let, you know, kind of let the guitarists do their thing.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that a lot of my bands, I kind of take a back seat and just play drums, which is, it's nice sometimes.
Yeah.
And then the last band is, again, I think I mentioned, it's just like a duo. It's me and one of my real close friends back from home in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And he is a pianist and a singer. He isn't, you know, trained or anything, you know, just kind of works on the side. So he doesn't, he's not a professional musician. He plays and writes songs, you know, in his free time. Yeah. And he'll bring them to me, and because I have the recording stuff and things like that and some compositional knowledge that I can help him out with. And so we put together some really nice, I don't know, I guess they're like kind of pop rock, you know, singer-songwriter, strummy guitar, yeah, you know, light vocals.
It's pretty cool. Each of the bands is very different. That's kind of like probably fun for you to like kind of switch it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think that I could do the same thing all the time. And I find myself with, you know, what I consider work, which is, you know, my classical music. It's really easy to get burnt out if I'm doing that too long. And so switching over to work a little bit on one of those things is...
You think part of that's because I would think a composer more than, say, maybe just a master violinist like Joey Hahn or something like that. You're more in the creative side of things than just the mastery of the instrument. So that you need those, you need that wide palette to keep from burning out, where I would think you maybe wouldn't be as bad if maybe for someone who is more an instrumentalist. You think this is the creativity part of it probably?
I would say there is an element of that, but there's definitely, performers can definitely get kind of burnt out doing the same thing. Because with them, it's practice. They're practicing all day, every day, and playing the same piece. And I did that for a bit early in undergrad, because at the graduate level, you just compose. That's what you do. You take other classes, but you don't have to perform. In undergrad, you do. You have to play an instrument pretty much anywhere. I think there might be a couple schools that you can just compose. But for me, I had to play drums and I had to practice. And I never really approached it that way. And that really burnt me out quick. But I pushed through and I got a lot out of it. And having not done that in a few years, I really feel it when I play. Like, you know, I'm rusty.
You don't miss it, though.
I don't know. I don't know.
You miss being pushed like that?
I don't think that I could do both that and be pushed with composition, because at that time, it was kind of a mix of both. Once you're to the graduate level, it's expected that you're...
You pick a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even in undergrad, you do, but not really towards the end. Specifically at Berkeley, you start with instrumental lessons, and you don't actually start your composition lessons until a little bit later. And so I think they overlapped for me by one semester where I had them at the same time. And that semester was a little bit tricky to find time for both. But at the very beginning, I could focus just on playing, and that was okay. And then later on when I had both, then it was like, and then when I focused on composition, I was like, okay, it's all right again. I miss being able to play like that. And when we tracked Snowchild's record, it was right in the shortly after the peak of that. So I was still, my chops were still up. And if and when we track a second record, which we're hoping will be in the next couple of years, I'll have to go back and do that again. So might have to wait until I'm done with my doctorate.
Is there a drummer that, like, who blows you away as a drummer?
Neil Peart.
Neil Peart, okay.
I could not do it. Right. I would not be here without him.
Yeah.
Living drummers, you know, younger drummers, I'm really admiring at the moment Ray Hearn. He's a drummer for a band called Haken. Mm-hmm. They're like a British progressive metal band. He's great. Drawing a blank at the moment. Who else?
Any jazz drummers that kind of influenced you at all?
I really enjoy Dave Weckl's drumming a lot. He does lots of different things, not just jazz, obviously, but I have a couple of his signature cymbals that I they're their mainstays in my setup. Trying to think. Why am I drawing a blank?
That's all right. What about composers? Who are some composers nowadays that you kind of think are doing some really cool things?
at the moment, that's also a tough question.
Yeah, I mean, it could be the last 50 years. I mean, where it doesn't have to be.
Well, no, and it's not even now. It's drawing a blank. I guess composers that I've always admired. Again, you know, going back to like Holst, which is a while ago, but any kind of that really post-romantic, like big sounding music. I love the Impressionists, Debussy, Ravel.
Yeah.
Coming a little bit newer than I really was inspired for a while and continued to be by a composer from Finland named Aino Juhani Rautavaara. So you're familiar with Jean Sibelius?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so he was kind of the next generation of Finnish composers after Sibelius. And he is kind of this, people like to call him like neo-romantic, but that gets like a bad rap sometimes and it has weird implications. Whereas his music's tough to describe. It's almost
which is
more.
Why you like it, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Really harmonically, like beautiful. Because a lot of new music can be one of two things, and this is a really oversimplification. But either really dissonant and like atonal, or very little tonality at all, and just like you know a couple notes, just small collections.
Landscape kind of.
Yeah. So his music is in a nice middle area where it really pushes the limits sometimes, but never fully diving into like atonality. And I really enjoy that a lot. And his orchestration is beautiful. It's very, I don't know, it's very Arctic to me. It's very just like barren and like hauntingly beautiful in like a desolate way. It's tough to describe. In a similar descriptions might apply to an Icelandic composer, Anna Thorvaldsdottir. Her music is more leans into even the kind of desolate stuff. And she's Rautavaara just passed away a few years ago. She's still young and still doing lots of stuff. So her music, I enjoy a lot of it. I think some of it isn't necessarily quite my thing, but the landscape she does. Basically, a lot of her pieces never go above like a piano dynamic. They're so soft.
Wow.
They go from like soft to nothing, whereas something like Rautavaara will go from soft to crazy loud.
Right.
She brings it down,
yeah,
and in a really beautiful way.
From Iceland, I think it's very fitting, right?
Yeah, like absolutely.
Kind of winter, dark.
Exactly, yeah. And I really have been kind of into that world recently. Also listening to some American composers, Adam Schoenberg, no relation to Arnold, but he writes some cool stuff for orchestra and wind ensemble that's, I don't know, it's something that I've kind of encountered recently in other people's music. It's kind of come out in my music a little bit, and the best way that I can think about it is like almost like Americana, but not like if someone like Aaron Copland was living today, maybe. I don't know how he would feel about that description, but it's lighter than, something like Rautavaara. His music is really heavy.
Yeah.
It's heavy and dark and in a beautiful way. And it has its beautiful, it's beautiful, beautifully dark. But Adam Schoenberg's music is much lighter and emotionally less heavy. It also uses a lot of, which is something that I like to use in my music, groove. A lot of classical music nowadays generally strays away from things that continue for a while in a groovy way, in the way that popular music might. But his music does; it's in a fray, or he's not afraid to kind of lean into. I'm just going to have a pattern go for a while,
yeah.
But not in a way that's like minimalist, not in a way that like Terry Riley might,
right?
But in a way that feels like, okay, we're just developing this thing, not just. We're not going anywhere. And I really like that. And that's something that I myself kind of incorporate and see how you can make that thing that's constant, that through line, develop over time. My teacher in my master's degree, Nancy Galbraith, writes some really cool music in a similar kind of vein. It's maybe a little bit lighter emotionally that way. Not always. Mm-hmm. She can turn the switch real quick. But in a way that I can only describe as very like Americana in a really cool, like not folky way, but kind of.
Yeah.
It's very different from the heaviness of like the European contemporary tradition.
Now, are you interested in film scoring? Because that's where your love began, right? You said that to begin with, and we haven't talked about that at all. Is that something you're interested in doing? And how does one get into that versus it seems like a different path?
It is. It is. Yeah. And I would say maybe. I wouldn't be opposed to it. And if presented the opportunity, I would absolutely take it. The thing these days with that is it's tough to get into, and obviously composing at all is tough to get into unless you're teaching, which is, you know, what I do and, you know, plan to continue doing indefinitely. But with film scoring, pretty much all of the, I know a lot of people who do film scores, and pretty much all of them studied that specifically to some capacity, had internships specifically in studios and things like that.
Got to know people.
Yeah. Because I'm not kind of in that world, it might be, it's not something that I necessarily want to, like, I'm just going to dive in and do some film scores. Yeah. The other thing is that involves kind of a submission to like a director. And that's not something that I dislike at all.
I would.
Yeah. Well, see, it's definitely not for everyone.
Right.
And that's not something that I like would hate, but at the same time, I would feel stifled by it, sure. I think. And I
it certainly restricts you.
Yeah. Like,
not just having a director, but you're
the
having
movie.
The movie itself. You have to follow the movie. You can't just create whatever you want.
So, right. Yeah. And that is what it is. Not even to one specific person, but with my music, my compositional process is all over the place. And can take some massive changes where I just like, I'm just going to redo this whole thing. Or I have this crazy different idea that's way different from what I originally thought. And in that kind of context, I'm not permitted to necessarily rethink, like, cause a lot of my pieces do have some kind of narrative kind of structure to them.
Sure.
And I can't just rewrite the narrative of a movie, you know? So I would worry that it would not necessarily work with my process,
but you need to find a director who is willing to let you write a score,
yes.
Then listen to it, and then make the film fit the
score. That would be incredible.
It'd be kind of an interesting little creative project if you could find a director. Because that would be kind of, I think that would be fun to see what would happen.
Amazing.
With that.
And I've always wondered about that with certain pieces and songs and things. Yeah. Like, you know, thinking about Rush and how they have like crazy long songs. What if you just made a movie to that song? And yeah, with lyrics that tells a story that's kind of given, but I have always kind of wondered about that. Another thing that I've been doing a little bit recently with some friends at UGA is taking either silent movies or like music videos, muting whatever music was there and not watching them with never having heard the music and improvising music with it. So we took an Avenged Sevenfold video that we hadn't seen the video, so we didn't know what song it was, and we just sat down. So, you know, Avenged Sevenfold's a rock band, and we took like piano and cello, classical guitar, and I was playing vibraphone,
right,
and just improvised a soundtrack to this really crazy animated video.
It's like, well, in the early silent films, isn't that when they play often without, sometimes they actually did have the sheet, but in some cases the musician would just be kind of improvising along with the movie. So,
And the another thing that I'm really fascinated by is when they recreate that live, when you know, orchestras will play the soundtrack live, because that's such a it takes a lot of effort on the part of especially the conductor, because the musicians, they still have to, you know, follow, and sometimes there'll be weird things that they're not expecting just with the pacing of the movie.
Sure.
But the conductor watching the film and having to know where the music, that's insane to me.
Yeah. Is conducting something that you love to do, or are you just really a composer and you conduct when you have to?
I actually, my undergraduate program, I did a minor in conducting. So
So you do love it.
Yeah, I enjoy it quite a lot. I don't know.
Love it may be strong.
I would reserve the word love for composing.
Okay.
And even then, it's like a weird relationship that I have.
Most days you love it.
Most days. But yeah, conducting, I would say, I like it a lot.
Okay. We always ask everybody this who comes on, what's a book that's had an impact on you in your life?
I think my favorite book of all time is Lord of the Rings. I don't think I have ever read a book, and unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of time to read anymore. So I read like, you know, a little bit a day.
Sure.
But I used to read just books and books and books every day. And I don't think I ever came across, and that was like the pinnacle. And I'm still trying to find something that like.
What'd you think of the film score of the movie?
Beautiful. Yeah. Howard Shore's music is insane. And I was just watching a video recently where they dissected the first appearance of the Fellowship theme. So the that where that occurs the first time is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And the where in the film that it occurs, it's not, you know, right when they're in Rivendell. It's like shortly thereafter. And the way that it's preceded by this really dissonant, uncertain music, because, you know, they're going off to what they presume are their deaths. And then all of a sudden it builds up and you have this triumphant fanfare. And it's
amazing.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's probably one of the few, I'm trying to think if there's any other classic literature like that, where the film really kind of hit in the same way that, you know, most people that I know who love the books love the film as well.
Yeah.
That's not usually the case.
No.
So, and you know, the music, everything just seemed to work for that. Maybe not The Hobbit, but
I actually never watched The Hobbit.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to write it.
You're right. But The Lord of the Rings, it just seemed, everything just seemed to like work.
I think because of just how much they didn't cut things short because of how long those films are.
Yeah.
They kept almost everything. There's a few things that they that aren't exact, but they really went for replication of the story.
Yeah, they make that film 10 years earlier, and you know, films are shorter in that time period. It would have been of course the special effects weren't as good either, but even if you took that equation out, just the fact that they would have had to probably cut a whole lot more.
Right. And what I was thinking also, what if they did it 10 years later, like when they made The Hobbit?
Oh yeah.
Would it be like 8 films? You know, I don't know how you divide that. 6 films.
Right. We took everything you ever wrote and put into one film, and then we added some stuff.
It would just literally be the director's cut version.
Nothing's left out.
No.
Yeah. All right. So where can people find information about you, your bands, your music? Where can they listen to you? All that good stuff.
You can go to my website, which is Jacob Shanley, S-C-H-O-E-N-L-E is my last name, .com, jacobshanley.com. That'll have my bio, contact, list of pieces, things like that. My SoundCloud has some music on it, which is Jake Shanley. You can find Snowchild, which is, you know, my current band, Spotify. You can find us on Instagram.
2 words.
Hopefully tours someday soon. Dream Spectrum's also on those things. Other project to be named has not put anything out yet, but you'll find it there at one of those places when it is officially out.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing your band play here live one day.
Absolutely. So, yeah. We're hoping to get here soon.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it, Jay. Yeah.
Glad to have you.
That was fun.